So we're back in the sermon series, Open Invitation. It is a series we have been in and out of several different times over, honestly, I think at least 2, if not 3 years. And the reason we keep bouncing in and out of it is that this series is really just a journey through the Gospel of Luke. We basically are just taking chunks of verses at a time and making our way, plodding our way through the Gospel of Luke, taking each story, each interaction, whatever it is, as it comes, and then asking, what do we still have to learn from this today? Hoping to get, by the time we're done, a really broad picture of what Luke's Gospel is about. And the theme, open invitation, comes from the idea that in Luke's Gospel, you see a lot of people being welcomed into the kingdom, being welcomed into the presence of Jesus that you would find unexpected, especially if you lived in the time and place in which Jesus lived in his world. Today, though, we're going to focus on something Jesus teaches about having good eyes. Jesus is going to teach in this passage in Luke 11, we're going to get to momentarily, about what it means to have good eyes, and he's associating that with either being full of light or full of darkness. So let's get right to it. Luke chapter 11, verses 33 to 36. No one lights a lamp and puts it in a place where it will be hidden or under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand so that those who come in may see the light. Your eye is the lamp of your body. When your eyes are healthy, your whole body also is full of light. But when they are unhealthy, your body also is full of darkness. See to it then that the light within you is not darkness. Therefore, if your whole body is full of light and no part of it dark, it will be just as full of light as when a lamp shines its light on you. Do we have good eyes? You may know this already, but your eyes are amazing. Now, some of you, I can tell, are wearing corrective lenses today. Some of you are wearing corrective lenses I can't see, like the ones attached to my eyeballs right now. But listen, your eyes are amazing, and I have the numbers to back it up. First of all, how many times do you think you blink in a day? You don't have to answer out loud, just sort of mentally processing. How many times do you blink your eyes in any given day? The answer is probably more than you think. You blink about 10,000 times every day, and almost never do you have to think about it. Your eyes just do that. Now, why are you blinking so much? It's because, essentially, your eyelids act like windshield wipers. They keep going up and down across the surface of your eye all day long, delivering and spreading around tear fluid with every blink that keeps your eyes moist, that allows them to be free from bacteria. So a lot is happening with every one of those 10,000 blinks a day. And that's not all. Your eyes also automatically adjust to movement, the movement that happens with your head, with incredible speed and precision. And I'm going to prove it to you. Are you ready? You have an interactive element today, so remember when you do the survey, sermons are interactive here, right? That's part of the fun. So here's what we're going to do. Take your arm, right? Hold it out at your arm. Take your hand, hold it out at arm's length, right? Like this, right? And then just move your hand back and forth quickly and watch what happens to your fingers, right? They get blurry. You can't actually keep up with it. But do the same thing, hand, arm's length away, and then move your head back and forth like this. And amazingly, your fingers still look unblurry. Why? Because your eyeballs are incredible, and they are adapting so quickly to the movement of your head that you're able to keep focus on your hand, on your fingers, even though your head is moving around like crazy. Your eyes start to develop, get this, just 2 weeks after conception. 2 weeks after conception, your eyeballs are already beginning to form. And throughout your life, your nose and your ears will keep growing, but your eyeballs will actually be the same size when you die as they are the day that you're born. They start when you're 2 weeks after conception, and when you're born, they stay the same size. It's incredible. If your human eye was a digital camera, do you know how many megapixels it would be? Your eye would be approximately 576 megapixels. And if you're going, I don't know what a megapixel is. It's a lot. It's a lot of megapixels. It's a lot. Your eye is incredibly high resolution when it comes to seeing and capturing the world around you. To the point that in the right conditions and with the right lighting, and this one I have a hard time believing, but it's on the internet, so you have to believe it's true. A human eye can see the light of a single candle 14 miles away. I don't know. That seems crazy, although I did read somewhere else this week that the human eye is so sensitive that a single photon of light, it's able to notice that. The light of a candle from 14 miles away, that seems crazy to me. Do you know how many times a second your eyes can change focus if needed? How many times every second your eyes can change focus? It's about 50. Your eyes can change focus 50 times every second if required. Your eyeballs are made up of over 2 million working parts, and your eye muscles are the most active in the human body. Even if you work out all the time, I promise you, your eye muscles are still the most active muscles in your body. Your eyes are second in complexity behind only your brain. 2 million working parts in your eyeball. And it's also fascinatingly unique. Your fingerprint has about 40 unique characteristics in it that show that you are you. Do you know how many unique characteristics your iris has? 256. 256 ways that we can look at the way your iris is shaped and know that you are you. This is why a lot of security is now going to retinal scans instead of fingerprints, because it's even more clearly you and not someone else. And your iris is not only incredibly unique, it can tell a lot about who you are, at least according to early studies in Sweden. Early studies are actually suggesting that our personalities are related to our iris. That in a sense, that the eyes are actually a window to your soul, and that you can see someone's personality traits in their iris. Here's how it works. I'm just going to read this. It's possible. There are some Swedish researchers have said that you can see someone's personality through their iris. You can tell if they are warm-hearted and trustful or neurotic and impulsive. What they did is they took close-up pictures of irises and then asked those same people to fill out questionnaires about their personalities. And they looked at different parts. Apparently in the iris there are pits and furrows. I don't know what any of that is. I didn't have time to go into that much detail, but there are pits and furrows in all of your irises. Iris eye? Iris? Every iris has pits and furrows in it. And here's what they found. The more pits you had, you're more likely you would be tender, warm, and trusting. The more furrows you had, you were more likely to be neurotic, impulsive, and given to your cravings. So young people, listen closely. In your dating life, truly look deeply into the eyes of the person that you're dating, because you may find, or just ask for their most recent retinal scans, and you may know more than you think just by looking at the eyes. So Jesus teaches about the eyes, but he obviously is not talking about irises or security or anything like that. He's not even talking about physical health. He's using the physical eyeball as a way to speak metaphorically about spiritual health. Now, the most common way to interpret and understand the passage we just read, and I had a feeling this was true, and some online research led me to believe that it is true. The most common way to look at the passage we just read is to say this: be really careful about what you take in through your eyes, because what you take in through your eyes could potentially lead to dark consequences, sinfulness, being sullied, and disobedient. This is captured, I found a quote from a pastor who had preached a sermon. This is a direct quote from the sermon. Jesus wants us to be genuinely transformed in our hearts, to become a people of purity. The things that you are exposed to make a difference to your heart. When what you look at, your patterns and habits impact your inner character, and that is what God cares about the most. And actually, the pastor Terman titled the sermon, "Be Careful, Little Eyes, What You See." Some of you are nodding because you know, be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. For the Father up above is looking down in love. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. In most passages, when this gets preached, it comes down to this. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build the very basic blocks of that sermon for you to show how we get there. Genesis 3, we usually start there. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some of it and ate it. She gave some to her husband who was with her and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened and they realized that they were naked, so they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. She saw the fruit. It was pleasing to the eye. She reached for it and then what happened? Bad things happened, right? This is the seeing things with the eye, and this is where it leads. You get general ideas like from 1 John chapter 2. For everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life comes not from the Father, but from the world. So the lust of the eyes is from the world, not the Father. If you follow after the lust of the eyes, bad things tend to happen. And then you talk about how Jesus preached on this very topic in Matthew chapter 5. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out, throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. I can't wait to preach that passage someday. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. But that is not the time for this. Today, we just acknowledge, right, when you look at a woman lustfully, what's happening, what you're taking in through your eyes. And then you bring home this sermon by doing like a firsthand account of when it happens. And you go to 2 Samuel 11, David and Bathsheba. One evening, David got up from his bed. He walked around on the roof of his palace. From the roof, he saw a young woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." But David still sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Again, see with your eyes, want what you see, blah, 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 bad things happen. This is, generally speaking, how you build the sermon that we usually get from this passage in Luke chapter 11. That we need to be careful where our eyes wander. And there is merit to that idea because we can connect it to all kinds of other passages like those. But here is the thing. That is actually not at all what Jesus is talking about in this passage when he talks about healthy and unhealthy eyes. Doesn't mean it's not true. See, it's not actually what Jesus is talking about. And can I be honest? I wish it was what he was talking about because that's actually simpler and easier than what he's actually talking about. Because you get to the end of that sermon and you go, got it. Just don't look at things that make me lust. Check, check, done, and done. Or maybe even better yet, just don't dehumanize people when I look at them and end up lusting. Check, check, done, and done. What Jesus is actually saying is far harder, I think, than that simple checklist. So what is Jesus talking about? If you have a Bible today or a translation on your app that has these verses, you see verse 34. There are little brackets by the words healthy and unhealthy, probably. It's because of how we maybe should understand those from a translation perspective. The NIV Study Bible simply says that the Greek for healthy implies generous, and the Greek for unhealthy implies stingy. So that's the first thing we kind of go, oh, wait a second. What's going on here? Maybe not exactly what I expect. So a couple of lines from a commentary I read this week that I think are extremely helpful to get us started at the right spot. According to the physiology prevalent in Greco-Roman antiquity, so the old ancient world in which Jesus lived, the eyes do not function by allowing light to come in, but by allowing the body's own light to go out. The eye is the conduit or the source of the light that makes sight possible. And this is a critical difference because we have been taught since, I don't know, 6th, 7th grade science, how does the eye work? Light comes in, bounces off a couple magical items that are back there in the back of your eyeball, and boom, goes to your brain and you can see. In Jesus' world, it was exactly the opposite. They believed that the light originated within your body and went out of your eyes. And that is how you could see what there was to see in the world. So moving on from there, Jesus' assertion, your eye is the lamp of your body, then expresses a commonly held view identifying the eyes as sources of light insofar as they allow the body's light to go forth. So what does all that mean? It means that given this physiology, the pivotal issue is whether your eyes are sick or healthy. That is, whether the body is full of darkness or light. This allows for Jesus' point, the identification of a sick eye as an indication of inner darkness, selfishness, covetousness, rebellion, and a healthy eye as evidence of an inner light, generosity, and sincerity. So in a real twist, a passage we typically interpret and apply as "be careful, little eyes, what you see," is actually about examining what's coming out of your lives as a way of evaluating what's happening on the inside of your life. I'll say that again. A passage that we typically say it's about what I need to be careful, what's coming into my eyes, is actually about saying what is coming out of your life and what does it say about what's happening on the interior. This shouldn't surprise us. Jesus teaches like this other places, including Luke 6:45, when he says the mouth speaks from the overflow of the heart. So what you see reflects what's happening on the inside. That Greek word we translate as healthy is haplous. It's only found twice in the entire New Testament, here and in Matthew in a parallel passage. And it means metaphorically sincerity, wholeness, guilelessness, or generosity. What's really interesting to me, and we'll circle back to this later, is that literally translated it can mean without folds. Without folds, or in other words, undivided, without having a double agenda, or my favorite way of explaining it, an overcomplicated life, without folds. And the Greek word for unhealthy, poneros, is much more common. We often translate it as evil. In the physical world, it would mean pain-ridden or disease. So what Jesus is really doing when he talks about eyes is nothing to do with our physical eyes and really doesn't have to do with what's coming into our eyes and making us sullied or impure. It's an invitation, honestly, to a spiritual eye exam. And if this is a spiritual eye exam, the question then becomes, what kinds of character traits are indicative of having healthy eyes, according to this passage? What kind of things reveal that we have unhealthy eyes, if this is about a spiritual eye exam? So using some of the words and the resources around those words of healthy and unhealthy, here are some of the conclusions that we arrive at about what it looks like to have good eyes. The first thing is sincerity, which simply defined means free from pretense or deceit, proceeding from genuine feelings, saying what you genuinely feel or believe, not dishonest or hypocritical. To have good eyes is to be sincere. And I think there's a really delicate balance that many of us are just frankly not very good at, of being sincere. Because to be sincere means that you are expressing your true and genuine feelings or beliefs, but from a Christian perspective, doing so with love, compassion, and gentleness. Can you express your true, genuine feelings and beliefs, but do so with love, compassion, and gentleness? Because I think what we do is we veer off one way or the other. Some of us become what I would call unfiltered truth tellers. Unfiltered truth-telling is what we do. Listen, I'm not holding back the truth, right? And we just say, it's the truth. Why would I need to do anything? Why would I need to consider anything? I just need to share the truth. And sometimes that means we don't do it with love or compassion or gentleness. But the other side that we tend toward and that we think is maybe a little better because it's not quite as divisive is when we go into keep the peace silence mode, when we actually don't share our own genuine thoughts and feelings, because that way everything stays calm and good. But it's not good, it's just a different version of bad. To be sincere is to live in that really narrow alley of saying, I will express my genuine, true feelings and beliefs, but I will do so in a Christ-honoring way. Having good eyes also means that you have wholeheartedness, according to the word and the resources behind it. The definition of wholehearted includes being sincere and being genuine, but then adds this flavoring of enthusiasm, determination, and earnest commitment. to pursue something with wholeheartedness. One resource I read this week said it's like the phrase to jump in with both feet. When you jump in with both feet, there is an enthusiasm and sort of a no-looking-backness that goes along with it. One of the easiest ways to understand it is when you go to a pool in the summertime, right? And some of you are the people who are like, I'm going to go by the edge, I'm going to dip my toe in, I'm going to see how that water feels, I'm going to judge what I want to do next, maybe I'll go in the shallow end, I'll go up to my knees, we'll see how things go. Others of you, you cannot wait to literally jump into the pool with both feet. Completely in. To do something wholeheartedly is to jump in with both feet without looking back. That reminds me of what Jesus himself says in Luke chapter 9. No one who puts the hand to the plow and looks back is fit for service in the kingdom of God. So to be wholehearted is to have good eyes, healthy spiritual eyesight. The last one, and Andy already mentioned this, and it's probably the most obvious one, generosity. Generosity is a sign that you have good eyes, that you have good spiritual eyesight. And if you look at the context, it actually makes sense. In Luke's gospel, Jesus will soon be talking to the Pharisees about tithing, so there's a relationship with generosity. In Matthew's version, it's even more impactful because Jesus follows this bit about having good eyes by saying, you cannot serve both God and money. You can't do it. Being generous is part of what it means to have good eyes. I love this definition I stumbled upon this week. Generosity stresses warm-hearted readiness to give more than the size or the importance of the gift. And that's so huge because for many of us, we think, well, I don't have enough to give a generous gift. I barely have enough to get by and give a little. But it's not about the size or the shininess or the importance of what you give. It's about having a heart that is tender to living with generosity, to being willing and even happy and excited to give. That's what a generous life looks like. And being generous with your treasure as well as your time and your talents, that is an indicator that you have good eyes, that your spiritual eyesight is good. When generous things come out of your life, whether it's sharing your time or your treasure or your talent, when those things are coming out of your life, it's an indication that there is brightness and light within that's coming out through your eyes. And maybe just as important as what good indicators are there of good eyes, what should we be on the lookout for when it comes to bad spiritual sight? What does it look like to have bad eyes? And listen, some of you in this room, again, I can tell you have bad eyes in a sense because I can see the corrective lenses that you're wearing. I don't know about you. The first time I went to the eye doctor, I want to say it was like 7th or 8th grade, right? And they put the thing down, right? And you do the one and the two and the one and the two. And then eventually you go back and they put the glasses on you for the first time. And your mind is blown. At least mine was. The first time I put on corrective lenses and I looked out the window of the building and I went, is that what a tree is supposed to look like? Not a general tree shape, but like branches. I can see branches of a tree. Because sometimes you don't know what good eyesight is until you have struggled through what it means to have bad, and you live in ignorance because you don't know what the world should look like. So let's be on the lookout for the things that are unhelpful to our spiritual eyesight, the things that reveal bad eyes. And the first one's the opposite of generosity. It's stinginess, a reluctance or unwillingness to give or to share. Or maybe to give something begrudgingly that you know isn't even close to what's actually needed. I would call this the Ebenezer Scrooge effect. You know, like, you know, well, flip a farthing over there because that's generous. No, that's not generous. That's stingy. We actually don't know exactly where the word stingy comes from, but we think it's an alternate pronunciation of stingy, which is kind of what it looks like, meaning that when we live this way, we hurt other people. We sting other people when we choose to live in a stingy manner instead of a generous manner. And I know some of you in this room and some of you watching online, I know that you live generous lives and you know the freedom and the joy that comes with living a generous life with your time, your treasure, and your talents, and it's incredible. A second way to know if you have some bad eyesight spiritually is covetousness. to simply eagerly desire something that someone else has. We read just a little blip of the David story. That's like the go-to. You know, he is on his roof. He looks out. He sees something that someone else has, and he says, I'm going to have that for me, right? And sometimes, though, covetousness is not quite that blatant. Sometimes covetousness is just about lacking the ability to be content, the ability to look at what you already have and go, that's enough. Or, and this is a big one, this is like a really shadowy one. If you've ever been in a place where you see somebody attain or receive something good and you can't be happy for them, that might be a sign that you struggle with some covetousness, because if they have it, guess who doesn't have it? You. And so when we struggle with covetousness, that is a sign that our spiritual eyesight needs correction. And the last one is overcomplication, or living a folded up life. And I told you we'd circle back. I couldn't get away from this idea. It just kept pushing up against me, the idea of what it means to live a folded up life as opposed to one without folds, the literal definition of healthy eyes. We fold a lot of things, right? We fold our laundry, we fold our towels, and it's for a purpose. As a quick side note, I was looking for a picture of folded towels, and I stumbled upon the very beginning of a thread. There is spirited online debate about the right way to fold a towel, and there are some passionate people. It's this way, it's got to be that way, and some people are like, you don't fold it, you roll it. That's how you really get, it's all about space saving and neatness and everything else. I didn't have time to go all the way down that, and thankfully, like I don't need that in my life. But why do we fold towels? We fold towels because that makes them space conscious, so we can fit more stuff in the closet or the drawer or wherever it might be. But think for just a moment about what happens when you fold that towel. Yes, it's neat and it's easily stored, but it necessarily complicates the usefulness of that item. When it is a folded-up towel, you can't just grab it and use it. You have to actually unfold the towel before it becomes useful to you again. Maybe think about it this way in our modern world. Sometimes when you store cables in your garage or in your shed, they get tangled up, not folded up, but maybe they get tangled up in a way that they become not useful when you first grab them. Have you ever gone to your garage or your shed or somewhere and you needed like a really long extension cord? This happened to me literally within the last week. Like a 100-foot extension cord, and you pick it up and it's all tangled in a mess. That there are a few more frustrating things on the planet than going, I have to fix this before I can actually use this. So when we live folded up, tangled up lives, we are actually limiting the functionality that God intends for us to have in His good world. When our lives get too tangled up with either commitments or distractions, our eye health suffers. Our spiritual vision suffers when we struggle being too tangled up, too folded up. Too many commitments or too many distractions or too many of all of those things. It takes me back to, I actually taught our first session of membership class today. I love teaching membership class. One of the key components of our friend's heritage is the idea of simplicity. We value simplicity. That we need to be living simple, uncomplicated, untangled lives because it brings us joy and it brings us usefulness to the God who loves us. And the ultimate goal is to grow so that we become full of light. It said at the end of that passage we read, if your whole body is full of light and no part of it dark, it will be just as full of light as when a lamp shines its light on you. William Hendrickson actually says, I really love the way he says this paraphrase. If your entire person is full of spiritual light, holiness, wisdom, spiritual rejoicing, etc., it will be really illuminated. In fact, it will be as bright as when the lamp is shining upon you with undiminished brilliance. That two-word phrase, man, undiminished brilliance. I hope that's what we want as we follow after Jesus, that we become so full of the light of Christ that what comes out of our lives is undiminished brilliance. And full circle, why do we want undiminished brilliance of the light of Christ coming out of our lives? Because he wants to put us on a lampstand. The more full of light we are, the more effectively we can give light to those around us when God puts us on the lampstand, so that when people come in, they can see the light. Let's check our spiritual vision. Let's see what's happening on the inside. Are we becoming more and more full of light or of darkness? A few things to think and pray through as we finish our time together studying the Word today. Do you struggle with genuine but compassionate sincerity? Are you more likely to dish out unfiltered truth-telling or conceal the truth for the sake of peace instead? Secondly, are you living a generous life with your time, with your treasure, with your talents? Do you need to loosen your grip or reallocate resources in one of those areas in the pursuit of better spiritual sight? Thirdly, do you live with a wholehearted, simple, focused approach to life? And if not, what kinds of things are tangling you up with either demands or distractions or maybe both? And lastly, just ask God to grow the light of Christ within you so that you can share his light with undiminished brilliance. I'm going to flip through those reflections one more time, and they're in your bulletin. You can take them home, think more about them. But in this moment of silence and reflection, allow the Holy Spirit to speak to your heart today, and we'll finish that time of reflective silence in a moment with a word of prayer.